Hello, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters, and we have a popular paradigm shifter with us, a fellow who's going to help you and I understand our body's workings and how to kind of improve them. Welcome to the show, Jim Emke, Nutrition Wizard.
Oh, well, thank you. We're glad to be back.
Yeah, I'm so glad to talk to you. My family and I have gone through hair analysis under your tutelage and have had huge results over going through hair analysis, having your analysis of it, and then discussing the nutritional supports for things like how we metabolize minerals, how we metabolize nutrition, and so on. So I'm really excited to talk to you about, well, we could talk about everything, but I'd like to talk about things like mental health, the digestive system, and how it can affect both the mental health and the physical health, of course. I'd like to talk about thyroid function and other parts of the endocrine system, and I'll let you talk about the kinds of things that you're really emphasizing lately. And generally, metabolism. Maybe we should start with metabolism. Is it true we can eat really well, but our personal system could maybe not crunch up the food in such a way as to support our metabolic requirements? Is that true?
Indeed. And there's a lot of individuality when it comes to one's metabolism. And you mentioned hair analysis earlier, Veronica, and that's one of the more unique ways of getting insight into one's metabolism, because the hair analysis reveals the tissue chemistry. Blood chemistry and tissue chemistry can be very different. In fact, they are very different. Blood is heavily regulated because it must be homeostatic, which means stable, sameness. So homeostasis is a common word you'll hear all around medical circles, and it has to be stable. The blood is the life stream of the body, so it won't vary very much at all, and it's heavily regulated. And therefore, it's hard to pinpoint a metabolic tendency in the blood. You can even have major disorders and tumors, cancer, and unless you're doing specialty tests, you won't pick it up in the blood very easily until it's advanced. A couple of classic examples about the distinction between blood and tissue chemistry, and again, hair is tissue, is calcium. That's a classic example, because in the blood, calcium is so important for a number of reasons: transportation of nutrients and substances, alkalinity of the blood. It's so important that the parathyroid gland is dedicated in regulating the blood calcium level. And if there's an issue, the parathyroid gland will sacrifice the tissues and pull calcium out of the blood, out of the tissues, and put it in the blood.
Pull it out of the bones or what?
Bones, exactly. Out of the tissues, out of the bones, and put the calcium in the blood, because the blood is so much more important than the bones. And the body can waste bones for decades before it really becomes a serious problem. And that's actually the chemistry behind osteoporosis in our culture today.
Oh, how interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way. So one thing you're saying to me is sort of reminding me of, like, when you're pregnant, the fetus will take whatever it needs from your system. And you're saying blood functions that way as well. Is that right?
Yes, because the blood is such a priority. It is the priority in the body. As long as the blood is stable, the body can live. When the blood starts to get whacked out, so to speak, it can put the body in a crisis very quickly. And that's why so many factors in blood chemistry are regulated. And I mentioned calcium, regulated by the parathyroid gland. The only time you'll see an irregular calcium in a blood test, basically, I should say almost the only time, is when the parathyroid gland is malfunctioning. And so a person, say, for example, a person with severe osteoporosis, even dying of osteoporosis, which is possible, they'll have a normal blood calcium. But you'll see major irregularities in the tissues. You'll see it in the hair analysis. You'll see it in the DEXA scan and those types of things. And that's just one example. The same thing with, like, electrolytes. Sodium, potassium are so important in the blood. They will not vary unless there's something big going on. Yet in the tissues, you do a hair analysis, and if there's an issue with tissue sodium or tissue potassium, it's evident right away. And tissue sodium specifically relates to the adrenal function, and tissue potassium specifically relates to thyroid function. So you can start to discern metabolic characteristics in the hair analysis, which are unique and hard to come by otherwise. And that's why hair analysis with the right type of lab will always provide you with a metabolic tendency, or your metabolic type, I should say.
Mm.
And the hair analysis is good at pinpointing whether a person is sympathetic or parasympathetic dominant. The nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, has two branches, the sympathetic, which is like the gas pedal, the get up and go, and then there's the parasympathetic, which is like the brake pedal compared to the gas pedal. And most often, people will tend in one direction or the other, and you can discern that from the hair analysis.
Now, can you change what your style is, if it's called a style, your metabolic system?
Type.
Can you change that? So if yours is a slow type?
Yes, you can. So if it comes out as a slow type, that would mean parasympathetic dominance, and that's generally associated with high calcium, low phosphorus, and things that slow the system down. And calcium, of course, is, you know, nature's tranquilizer. It's essential, and you got to have it. It's vitally important, but in excessive amounts, it's problematic. You don't want excessive calcium depositing in soft tissues and creating problems like that, suppressing phosphorus, suppressing magnesium, which are the two minerals that interplay with calcium the most.
So that's if you have a slow metabolic system and it's parathyroid-driven, you're saying that's what that is, right?
Yes, exactly. If what you'll see in hair chemistry with parasympathetic dominant metabolic types, or a metabolic type that's parasympathetic dominant, you'll see excessively high levels of tissue calcium.
Okay, so before we leave that little section, that's fascinating to me, actually. But does that have an impact on a person's emotional nature?
Of course, because we're talking nervous system.
Okay.
So the sympathetic and parasympathetic both relate to the nervous system. So a parasympathetic person is going to have a much more sluggish nervous system. They're going to be more inclined towards depression, fatigue, and issues like that. A sympathetic dominant person is going to be more prone towards hyperactivity and high-strung nervous system, very kind of like electric. And you'll see distinct differences in children and adults. Most adults gravitate towards parasympathetic dominance or slow metabolic type. Most children are fast metabolic types. You often wonder, where did that kid get all that energy from, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They never stop going. Well, that's because they got a sympathetic nervous system that's wound tight. And hair chemistry is one of the best ways of discerning ADHD type kids. You'll see that they're overwhelmingly sympathetic dominant. They've got high phosphorus, low calcium, which is the opposite of most adults. They'll tend to have high copper, low zinc. They'll tend to have heavy metals, because in hair you can test for lead and cadmium and mercury and arsenic and aluminum. And that's the pattern that you see with ADHD kids. They're way too parasympathetic. They're way too sympathetic or fast types. They have too much phosphorus, not enough calcium, oftentimes running high copper, which means low zinc. It's kind of synonymous. The two go together. And so you can actually, with hair chemistry, get actual objective science about ADHD patterns, whereas otherwise the diagnosis in pediatric offices is strictly subjective. Well, he's got these symptoms, the teacher says this, the teacher says that, the parents say this. Okay, put him on Ritalin, you know. There is no objective diagnosis for ADHD, but hair analysis...
You just said that sometimes it's related to high toxic metals, right?
Yes, exactly. The three areas that I look for that are pretty well known amongst hair analysis circles with ADHD is low calcium, high phosphorus, high copper, low zinc, and heavy metals.
And heavy metals. And I suspect that most doctors or most of the normal therapy sessions don't look at that, don't look at the heavy metals, eh?
No, you know, in the old days, in the 80s, in our clinic in Milwaukee, we could get hair analysis covered by insurance because there was a CPT code or insurance code for heavy metal diagnosis, toxic metal diagnosis, and hair analysis was acceptable, you know, in medical circles for that purpose. Now that's just no longer available in the HMO managed care world of insurance today. Yeah. It's ironic because at our clinic in Milwaukee in the 80s, that's when we got insurance coverage for most of our work. My wife, as you know, was a registered dietitian, had a master's in nutritional science from the University of Wisconsin, and was a nutrition instructor at the university for a period of time. And we had MDs and DOs in the office. And so, you know, whatever lab work they ordered was basically covered, because in those days you had a private policy with an insurance coverage, and, the insurance company was more or less obligated to pay for whatever the doctor ordered. And it was actually the heyday of alternative medicine getting covered by insurance.
Wow.
That disappeared, you know, entering the 90s with HMOs and the managed care world.
Wow. Well, anyway, I'm very, very excited about this ADHD kind of commentary that you're making. But I also, when I was little, I was very, very, very hyperactive, and I apparently have a slow metabolic system. So I'm wondering, I'm just extrapolating from that and other things we've talked about, that maybe as we age, we kind of clear up some of the trauma and our brains can get healed. Is that possible?
Absolutely. You'll see that whole, you know, we've all heard the phrase, he grew out of it or she grew out of it. You know,
yeah, but it's true, huh?
It's true. Puberty changes everything dramatically. Hormones, you know, steroid hormones absolutely dominate body chemistry in profound ways. So as we get older and our systems shift, and the wild card here, though, is we have a whole generation of people growing up that have been put on amphetamines, Ritalins, Adderalls, whatever, you know, the amphetamine world. But even then, in my experience, just observationally with clients, is that even those kids kind of grow out of that and hopefully didn't become too addicted to the amphetamines, which are very, very hard on the body. And isn't it ironic that speed, because that's what amphetamines are, you know, Ritalin is speed, actually slows the kids down, or it doesn't really slow them down in a sense, but it keeps them focused. But for any of those who went to college and took White Cross or any of those old speed to study, do you remember that era? I remember it well.
I do remember, yeah.
That's... same drug. It's just, you know, it's the same drug.
And we used to take diet pills so we could stay up all night and play.
Same drug. It's an amphetamine. White Cross, that was what they called it. In the 60s in at the University of Wisconsin where I went. And you could buy it on the street or you could steal your mother's diet pills.
I know. It didn't take me very long to know that a diet pill would just bonk me for a long time. So
I was
sensitive for those, you know.
We had a similar experience because I took them once to study and I crashed afterwards. It was like the worst experience. And that was it for me. I went, of course, I was pretty hyperactive too. People that are already pretty wound up, have sympathetic dominant nervous systems when they're young, but, you know, this is additional amphetamines, the speed of, you know, that kind of thing can really mess up their nervous system. It sure messed up mine for a short time.
And me. It's also interesting to me that this whole, like, the lay of the land is more and more and more toxic, right? So what we're talking about is more and more and more people with ADHD or ADD or whatever it's categorized as. It kind of makes sense to look at that, doesn't it?
It does, indeed. I mean, we've polluted the environment in profound ways that it's going to take a long time to undo. And it's not getting any better. I mean, there's just more and more chemicals dumped on the soil, you know, put into the atmosphere in one way or another, the water. You know, chemtrails, there's all sorts of controversy about what chemtrails are, although that seems to be defined more and more. And it appears as though they're spraying aluminum silicate and different things like that to reflect sunlight to cool the earth. Mm-hmm. And who knows what else is being sprayed into the atmosphere. But it's a chemical world, much, much, much more chemical than when we were growing up in the 50s and the 60s.
Remarkable to me that they don't seem to talk about that as having a huge impact on autism, perhaps. You know, do you know what I mean?
Right. You know, the way the government is now, it's basically controlled, you know, by industry and corporate interests.
And they're controlled by money, right?
Well, sure. I mean, I don't know exactly where to draw the line there, but you got Monsanto and you've got all these chemical entities that have more or less, bought and paid their way into legislation. And, you know, it's political. I know we don't want to get too political here, but it's hard not to acknowledge that the entire environment has become so much more chemicalized, if that's a word, than it ever has been. And it's going to create new and unusual circumstances and conditions, health conditions. And kids, you know, I weigh 185 pounds, and so I've got a body that can buffer some exposure. But if you're a little child and you weigh 40 pounds, you don't have much buffering there. You can't dilute, you know, what you're exposed to. And that's one of my concerns about 25 to 30 vaccines before a child even enters kindergarten. When we were kids, it was smallpox and polio. That was it.
Yeah, and we were grateful for some of those. I try to look at it this way, or at least I'm trying to understand from your brilliant work and other people's as well, that probably approaching illnesses or limitations in kids and so on, it would be best to go into the toxicity right off the bat, wouldn't it?
Right off the bat. That's the first thing. Somebody inquires of my services, contacts me, email, phone, whatever, and they're dealing with a child, ADHD, whatever, the first thing I say is I want to see hair analysis. I'd like to see the blood tests, you know, that have been done, and that can be very useful. There can be other factors involved here, but if the child has lead, if the child has high copper, if the child has low calcium, you know, you can spin your wheels forever trying to treat it and not get anywhere. You know, diet restrictions, gluten-free and dairy-free, whatever, and they can help. But if there's one of those major metabolic imbalances underlying the situation, you're going to spin your wheels trying to really make progress.
And that goes back into that question I asked you at first, is that if people have these imbalances, maybe through heavy metals or through some sort of genetic predisposition, you can feed them the best food in the world and it's going to be antidoted or it's going to be interrupted by some of these other influences, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it would help to feed them the best food in the world and avoid all the contaminants and things, for sure. I would never downplay that in any way, but if there's lead, too much lead in the system, too much mercury in the system, which is a common preservative in all of your commercial vaccines and flu shots, if there's too much aluminum, which is also added to flu shots and vaccines, and it's accumulated in this little kid who weighs 40 or 50 or 60 pounds or whatever, mm-hmm. The impact is pretty significant, and you won't be able to undo it with a good diet. Although a good diet will help.
Mm-hmm. And a good sleuth is somebody, well, I guess the hair analysis is probably the best way to check out the toxic metals, huh?
Well, yes, I think.
Do you do hair analysis for little kids?
Oh, sure, absolutely. It's one of my favorite tests. You know, you only need a quarter gram of hair, and so it's easy to collect hair samples from children, too, as opposed to blood tests. And blood tests aren't going to reveal this. You feel the last place the body wants to find heavy metals or allow heavy metals is in the blood. Christopher Shade is really one of the top people in this field. Quicksilver.com is his website. He tests hair, blood, and urine. And from the three mediums, he can really put together excellent information. But the thing about the hair is that in the case of mercury, which is his specialty, actually, hair shows what they call methylmercury, or a more active kind of mercury, a more volatile type of mercury, which is the type they put in vaccines, which is the type you eat in fish. When I moved to Hawaii, I do my hair chemistry like every 6 months. And when I moved to Hawaii, I knew my baseline with hair. And I ate, when we moved there in 2000, we could get ahi quality sushi for like $9.99 a pound that was caught the night before. So I kind of overdid it. And I was eating it like three times a week. And 6 months later, my mercury in my hair was off the chart.
Hmm.
Yeah, it got my attention. So I absolutely discontinued eating any ahi, but I continued to eat, you know, reasonable amounts of Ono and Mai Mai, which are much, much smaller fish, so therefore contain much less mercury. And within 6 months, it was back to normal.
Oh, wow,
so,
really?
Yes, the hair.
You know, I was talking to someone who's a lab tech and is very, very smart and really prefers science to alternatives. But she was saying, you know, this whole thing, she says, you went and got all the mercury taken out of your teeth. What a terrible waste of money that's been proven by dentists. And my reaction to that was inner musing, because I realized that when I got all the mercury, and apparently I had very high levels, taken from my teeth, and my teeth had been bad from the time they came in, I changed really quickly. And I never heard anybody say your brain's going to change really fast, but mine did. Do you know about that?
Well, it's certainly a possibility. I mean, there's no debating the fact that mercury is the most powerful neurotoxin on the periodic table and one of the most powerful neurotoxins known. So there's no debating that. I mean, you can't discuss, you know, there's no
question. Well, what she said was, well, then the dentists would be losing their minds if that was true.
Well, that, you know, the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, way back in the 80s, I remember, because my wife being, you know, a former dietitian and a master's in nutrition, we subscribed to the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and they actually did a study on dentists because they had such a high rate of suicides and so many mental diseases and problems with such a high incidents in dentistry, and they were wondering about the mercury exposure. And they wrote, you know, they got into, like, you know, you drop a little mercury on a carpet, and how do you get it out of there? You know, in dental offices, a lot of them were carpeted, and they couldn't really draw any firm conclusions at the time, but there was a lot of suspicion around that. Dentists have an unusually high level of suicides and depression and mental disorders. I don't mean to be disparaging in any way towards dentists or dentistry.
But why couldn't they draw a conclusion?
Because, you know, proof is one thing. You know, anecdotes and theories are one thing, but proof is another thing. There's a double standard out there about proof. You know, placebo-controlled double-blind studies is really what you need. But so many meds are on the market that have never gone through that, especially chemotherapeutic agents and other agents that have never really been put to the same test.
Well, let me ask you this. Is it not true that if I were, say, a slow metabolizer or a fast metabolizer and had some toxic metals in me, some of those things would have a very different impact on me than they would on someone else who had a different kind of system? Is that why we can't, like, nail it down? Is that why we can't, besides the marketing force as well?
Yeah, the biochemical individuality that you kind of refer to here, it could certainly be a possibility, and nobody knows absolutely for sure. The thing about heavy metals, and if anybody's ever taken organic chemistry at the university level, they're used as catalysts. So if you want to make PVC, you have to dust the chemical process with a little bit of lead. If you want to make margarine, you know, to get the reaction to go, quote unquote, to go, you know, to make it happen. Now, these chemical reactions occur in the human body at low temperature, you know, 98 degrees, because of enzymes. You know, enzymes are the catalysts that allow all this biochemistry, this amazing biochemistry, to occur without high temperature, etc. And so that's how the body does it. But when you're doing it in the laboratory or in industry, and you're making PVC or you're making margarine or you're making whatever you're making, they have found just through trial and error that if they dust the chemical process with a little heavy metal, it oftentimes catalyzes the reaction. It gets it to go. It triggers the process. And, you know, so if you want to make margarine, you dust it with a little nickel. If you want to make PVC, you got to dust the reaction with a little bit of lead.
But if it's something edible, then you're going to take it on, right? Or will there be none left, supposedly?
I'm sorry, would you repeat that, please?
Okay, well, if you're dusting, you said margarine?
Yes, you know, exactly. You have to dust the oil with a little nickel to catalyze the reaction.
Mm-hmm. So does that not mean that we would ingest some of it?
Of course.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, unlike an enzyme, you know, which does its work and then no longer exists, you know, with heavy metal, it's there, sure. And so what about in the body? So in other words, because they're catalytic, what about a little mercury in the body? You know, what kind of reactions is that triggering? You know, because again, heavy metals are catalytic to chemical reactions. And we don't know, you know, we all think about lead poisoning or mercury poisoning or arsenic poisoning or something like that. That means excessively high levels. But what about just a little bit that catalyzes some kind of chemistry in the body that really isn't desirable?
Right. I mean, that's fascinating, isn't it?
It is. It is to me. And so you get to a point where you realize that's never going to be tested or proven, so you just want to avoid it as much as possible because there's not going to be any proof around it.
But Jim, what you're saying is we can't really avoid it. It's in and around many levels of the production of our foods, right?
Yes. Well, you can avoid it, do your best to avoid it. You can eat organic. You can avoid GMO. That's another subject in and of itself. You know, the whole GMO world, a whole other new strange substance added to the food supply. And this came up in the class at the co-op last Wednesday. It was interesting because we were talking a little bit about GMO and gluten-free and stuff like that. And I was mentioning that I've had a number of clients over the years, this hasn't been unusual, that have all these issues that were just referred to, you know, gluten-free, whatever, and they go to Europe and they can eat them. They can eat the gluten. They can, you know, they can eat dairy. It doesn't bother. Mm-hmm. I had a woman who had asthma so bad she was in and out of the emergency room, she went on a Mediterranean cruise, and her asthma completely cleared up. She came back to the United States, and it kicked in again. So then, spontaneously, in the class, half a dozen people raised their hands, and they want to tell their story about either their own personal experience or somebody they knew where exactly the same thing happened. They went to Europe, and their symptoms got better, and they could eat anything. And another person tells a story about a woman who's severely constipated, you know, one or two bowel movements a week, and She goes to Europe and she's eating the bread and all the things you don't want her to eat for constipation, and her bowels start moving great.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, I've noticed that a number of times over the years. But, you know, in Europe, GMOs are illegal. You know, and chemical agriculture certainly exists, but to a much less extent than in the United States. So the agricultural foundation of Europe is much more old world than what's happening in the United States.
Wow. And it's all just money-based.
You know, they don't prove anything, but, I mean, if you have asthma and you go to Europe and it clears up, it gets your attention.
You bet it does.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you don't care if it's a study, if anything's been proven or not.
But you know, it's really hard for people to really know what's going on here because you have to really wade through an awful lot of the spin or a lot of the news stuff. What do you recommend people read or source of learning?
I recommend Mercola.com. I mean, Joe Mercola, who's a physician in Chicago, but no longer really one of the top educators in this field. And he has a free website, you know, Mercola.com, MERCOLA.com. And Joe's a great teacher. You know, he's got his knowledge base. He's got a great brain, a wonderful mind. He's a good guy. I've known him for quite a while because our clinics were close to each other in Milwaukee, Chicago suburbs. And he's got the number one alternative health website in the world. Again, it's a free site. And regularly you'll receive articles and you can go into his archives and research anything. You can research any of what we've talked about in his archives.
Hmm.
It's the best educational site I'm aware of.
Wow. Well, I'm going to check it out. So go ahead.
Well, you can subscribe to, I think if you're more clinical, if you want to be a little more technical, Dr. Wright, Jonathan Wright, who's an MD in Seattle, he's, as far as I'm concerned, he's the number one medical doctor in the field, and I've been chasing him around the country for 30 years, 40 years, with him and Dr. Gaby and his colleagues to learn this field and to learn the biochemistry and that's associated with nutrition, et cetera. And he has a newsletter called The Wright Newsletter. It's not a free newsletter, but if you really want to get into excellent information that's diverse and clinical, and be able to apply it, you know, the Wright Newsletter, WRIGHT, and there are many others, too. Townsend Newsletter for patients and doctors is excellent. And of course, all these are on the web now. You know, Townsend Newsletter for patients and doctors, or doctors and patients. So if you really have a passion for this field, it's there to be had. You can educate yourself beautifully in this field.
Thank you. So I'd like to talk about mental health, because guess what? It's a big deal these days, is it not?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's huge. I mean, obviously, I mean, the percentage of people that I talk to, work with, who are taking, you know, mental health medications, SSRIs, dopamine, you know, whatever, reuptake inhibitors, et cetera, is extensive. I mean, I don't know the percentages, but it's huge.
Well, you know, if you look at the organs of the body or the endocrine system or whatever, or even just the brain and the heart, where are the strong, where do most of, for example, toxic metals, where are those repositories? Where does metabolism get stuck?
Well, we mentioned earlier, mercury is a neurotoxin, so that's neurological, that's mental, you know, that's nervous system.
So does that mean it lodges in the brain, or is this too simplistic picture?
Probably simplistic to see it that way, but it interferes with the neurological function of the body. It's a neurotoxin. So, the various miscellaneous, there are many substances, medications and such, which have effect on our mental health and much of which we don't even know about, but some are obvious. Thyroid function has a major effect on mental health. Adrenals, you know, are basically buffer the system from stress, whether it's situational stress, emotional stress, or physiological stress, chronic health issues, lack of sleep, chronic pain, diseases. There's all sorts of stress chemistry, stress hormone chemistry, cortisol, et cetera.
I mean, the stress that we have in our own bodies creates a huge biochemical reaction, doesn't it?
Exactly. You know, there's chemistry going on here, and there's oftentimes underlying biochemical factors associated with depression and fatigue. Or if you just look at fatigue, I mean, that's the number one complaint. If you in a GP's office, in a nutritionist's office, in a naturopath's office, fatigue is... And when you're fatigued all the time, well, what's the likelihood of being depressed? Much greater, dealing with chronic fatigue. So I don't know that there's a line of demarcation between physical and mental, because there's such an interplay there. And brain health, you know, the brain is part of the body. It's part of the physical reality of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever's going on in brain chemistry is going to have a major effect on one's mental health.
Or in our intestinal tract, it really affects your brain too, doesn't it?
Thank you for bringing that up, Veronica. Yeah, of course. You know, there's so much that has come out in the last couple of years about how the gut, and Mercola has really led the way in this regard. I mean, he's published and written so many articles on the subject that, you know, what's going on in the gut has profound influence. In fact, in Gershon's book, The Second Brain, which is available on Amazon or bookstores, The Second Brain by Gershon, G-E-R-S-H-O-N, he's an M.D., and he points out that like 80% of the dopamine and serotonin, neurohormones, neurotransmitters, epinephrine, norepinephrine, all those things, they're made in the gut. They're made in the gut. And so gut health is profoundly influential on one's state of mental health. Candace Pert, who's a researcher, was a researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health and wrote the book Molecules of Emotion. She's the one who really put this in motion when she discovered in the early 90s that the gut had more receptor sites for the molecules of emotion than any other part of the body except the limbic system.
Hmm.
I mean, the gut, she was stunned. I mean, she was in a state of shock. Nobody before that time really anticipated anything like this. And her and one of her colleagues figured out how to trace these chemicals that are released under different spontaneous emotions. So if a person is happy and laughing and having a good time, they release a chemistry, you know, based on that. And the gut is loaded with receptor sites. So if a person is despaired, despondent, and full of anxiety, they create a chemistry. And the gut receives that chemistry.
Well, you know, when you think about it, we know, don't we? Because we say, well, I have a gut reaction to that person. So we've known that for centuries, haven't we?
You have a gut feeling?
Yeah, gut feeling, right?
Lump in your throat.
Yeah, lump in your throat. That's back to the thyroid, isn't it?
Exactly. You know, just like heartburn. Why would they call indigestion in the stomach heartburn? Because it creates heart-like symptoms.
Mm.
How many people go to the emergency room thinking they're having a heart attack when actually they're having heartburn? You know, why is the sphincter muscle between the esophagus and the stomach? It used to be called the cardiac sphincter. And now they've changed the name to the esophageal sphincter. But in old-time medicine, there's that connection between the stomach and the heart.
Well, here's something interesting, because I'm an intuitive, which you know. And people will call me and say, you know, I'm having a really terrible time with my heart. And I'll say, well, wait a minute, it's low, it's down in your intestinal tract there. And
right.
Then when we can move that, their heart, you know, can you talk a bit about that link for people?
Well, you mean you just talked about it relative from an intuitive perspective. So
yeah.
I'm not.
Okay. All I'm saying is that, you know, you've been talking about the intestinal tract and the endocrine or the neurotransmissions that come up from there and the heart. And the heart does reflect when we've got allergenic reactions too, doesn't it? And so when I work with somebody energetically and I see that the heart problems are coming from their intestinal tract, I don't really know physiologically exactly what it is, but I know that we can ease the heart problem from the intestinal tract. So I just thought you'd be able to explain that even better because I'm not physiologically.
Well, no, and I don't know the exact pathway either, but there's no doubt that it's occurring. There's no doubt in our own personal experience. And then, of course, with Pert's work and then Gershon's work, they put it into scientific terms and proof, but, you know, the connection is obvious. There's a profound connection between every aspect of body chemistry. In fact, one of the handouts that I provide in the intestinal class that I teach here at the local co-op deals with how the gut affects heart disease and how the gut affects obesity.
Oh, good.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of proof in that, and I don't really have it at the tip of my fingers here to be able to elaborate on it, but it's there, and you know, I'd be happy to send you those articles. Because
I would really like that, because I'm always very excited about these connections. You know why? It's because a lot of what you're teaching us, Jim, is that you're alleviating a lot of that like hopeless frustration that people have with their health. You're saying a lot of things are changeable, movable.
I'm suggesting, yes, that we can take control of our health, absolutely. And that's a phrase that Dr. McColl uses a lot, and that's a phrase that's the name of the class that I teach at the co-op. Learn enough. You don't have to learn that much. You don't have to really be a student of it, but it's nice to have a little bit of an educational foundation to kind of motivate and keep you motivated about the things that you're doing to take control of your health. You want to, you know, the right type of diet, the right use of supplementation, certain tests that can help you evaluate what's going on. We talked about hair analysis, and I'm also a big fan of blood tests. You can do a lot with blood testing as far as sorting out various things that are going on with people. You mentioned thyroid function earlier. You know, gosh, I mean, it's absolutely crucial to have adequate thyroid function. And there's been a big change in the medical community as to how they diagnose thyroid function and how they treat thyroid function. And personally, I think it's been a tremendous change for the worse, you know, because the way thyroid is do you mind going into the thyroid a little bit?
I would love you to go to thyroid because it really has a huge impact on mental health and your whole well-being.
Sure, and you know,
and
a lot
body
of
pain, right?
Everything. Yeah, I mean, the thyroid is a huge player. And you know, there's only a couple of substances, to the best of my knowledge, and I might have this not quite completely accurate, but this would be about 95% accurate. To the best of my knowledge, there are three substances which have receptor sites in every cell in the body, and thyroid hormone is one of them.
Oh, really?
Vitamin D, as in David, is another, and ironically, cannabis is the other.
Wow.
I don't know what that means, but I'll let your listeners decide that one for themselves. But yeah, the thyroid hormone has receptor sites in every cell in the body. It's one of the very, very few substances that does. There might be some other items that do, but those are the three I'm aware of. And I think that wraps it up almost incomplete, but who knows what they'll discover tomorrow or the next day.
But so what you're saying is the thyroid testing system has changed radically. How has it changed? Because a lot of people are getting half their thyroid removed. I keep meeting people doing that.
Well, yes. And when you get into certain thyroid diseases, I'm referring a little bit more to thyroid function. I don't know. I guess you can call it a disease, like hypothyroidism. I guess it's a disease, but it isn't really disease tissue. It's just a malfunction. Or
Hashimoto's.
Yeah, Hashimoto's, now that would be more in the disease category because it's an autoimmune problem. Autoimmune, in by medical definition, means hyperactive immune system. So an autoimmune system is like somebody with ADHD going off the walls, and the immune system is going hyperactive, and it's damaging healthy, normal tissue.
Mm.
And if it happens in the thyroid, it's either Hashimoto's or Graves. Hashimoto's would be when the immune system is causing problems that are forcing the thyroid into a hypo function, a weak function. That's Hashimoto's. If on the other hand, the flip side of that coin is occurring and the thyroid is going hyperactive because of the immune system, that's called Graves' disease. But there are also many people that have hypothyroidism without Hashimoto's, meaning the immune system's not a factor, and there are some people that have hyperthyroidism without the immune system, so they don't really have, without immune system involvement, so they don't really have Graves' disease, but they still have hyperthyroidism. But
does it matter why? Does it matter how it started?
It does, as far as I'm concerned, and it's treated differently medically. So if you have like Graves' disease or hyperthyroidism, you know, they might want to remove the thyroid or burn it out with radioactive iodine. Or there are some meds that can regulate that to some extent, but then you're on meds for a long, long time, and of course there's all side effects and consequences. So the vast majority of doctors in the field, they prefer the radioactive iodine treatment to kind of burn out the thyroid, and then they damage the thyroid or remove it surgically, and then you go hypo. So you went from hyper to hypo, and now you go on thyroid medication. The real change that's occurred, though, is that the actual thyroid hormones are not even considered to be the most important aspects of diagnosing and treating thyroid function anymore. You know, you have two basic thyroid hormones. Of course, there's always subsets, and it gets more complicated, but in general, you've got T4 and T3.
Okay.
The only accurate way to measure those two is free T4 and free T3. The difference is that T4 has four iodines attached to the molecule, and T3 has three iodines attached to the molecule. The body, the thyroid, basically makes mostly T4. The T4 is converted downstream into T3 by removing one of the iodines, and that activates it. And now you have a highly active type of thyroid molecule, hormone, which does most of the work associated with the thyroid, not T4, but T3. They're both important. And historically, you would test everything. You would test not just you test T3, you test T4, and you would also test TSH. TSH stands for thyroid stimulating hormone, but it's a pituitary hormone that's like the gas pedal to the thyroid, so it's the regulator. Mm-hmm. But it really only regulates T4. It doesn't regulate T3. And again, T3 is the most active and does most of the work. So the pituitary gland, the TSH, is useful information. But in the last 15 years, the medical community has shifted into using TSH as their almost their exclusive, you know, point of interest. They won't diagnose thyroid issues until the TSH is high, because or low, I should say. But with hypothyroid, with weak thyroid, the TSH usually will go high, because the pituitary is the gas pedal, so it's putting its foot to the floor, you know, pushing the gas pedal to the floor, trying to rev up the thyroid. But the thyroid's not responding. So when a TSH is elevated, that means the thyroid is weak, because the thyroid's not responding to the gas pedal or the stimulation of the pituitary hormone, TSH. But the problem is, and let's just talk hypo right now, because that's the vast majority of cases. The overwhelming vast majority of thyroid cases are weak, hypothyroid. Mm-hmm. So you look at the TSH, it's high, but you don't even really look at the T4 and the T3, and you start to adjust medication according to the TSH. Or if you, and that's really doesn't complete the picture, because you need to know what the actual thyroid hormones are doing. And even if a person, and 80% of thyroid problems are in women, and by the way, for those who are interested in blood typing, 80% of all thyroid problems occur in old blood types.
Old blood types?
Blood types. And the Japanese medical community has been pointing this out for decades, and nobody looks at it. And because I do a lot of thyroid work and I see a lot of blood testing, it's absolutely uncanny.
Wow.
How dominant old blood types are relative to hypothyroidism.
Wow.
And women, of course, it's usually passed on the maternal bloodline, but not always. Always exceptions. I'm thinking 80-20 here, you know, as far as propensity. Mm-hmm. So with thyroid, you need to know the actual levels of free T3 and free T4. And you can only measure T3 and T4 accurately in the free form. So it has to be free, F-R-E-E as in freedom, free T3, free T4. Total T3 is inadequate. T4 thyroxine is inadequate. It has to be free T4, free T3.
Hmm.
And then you adjust your dosage according to those hormones. It doesn't really matter what the pituitary gland is doing. Just like when a woman goes into menopause and her, you know, her FSH and her LH go sky high, it doesn't hurt her health. And FSH and LH regulate estrogen and progesterone in a woman. And so when a woman goes through menopause and those and the estrogen and progesterone go way down, well, then the pituitary gland, the FSH and the LH, go higher and higher and higher. They go way high, and the pituitary is trying to get the ovaries to produce estrogen and progesterone, but they're not responding. So the FSH and the LH stay high. There's no disease consequence associated with that. There's no problem with that. That's just normal menopause. But in thyroid, they're trying to regulate everything according to TSH. So
well, are the hot flashes? Backing up just for a sec here.
Sure.
Is that what creates hot flashes, that they're going higher and higher?
No, it's not from FSH and LH, but it is from low estrogen, yes. So
okay.
As the estrogens go down for some women, they develop hot flashes. Some don't.
Okay.
And some women will lose, you know, the way they're genetically set up is when they go through menopause, their estrogen may crash. You see, after menopause, after the ovaries stop producing their normal, you know, level of estrogen, progesterone, et cetera, the adrenals pick up the slack. So then your adrenal glands become your primary producers of estrogen and progesterone. If a woman has pretty strong adrenal function, she can compensate for the loss of the estrogen and progesterone, and she can go through menopause with no symptoms at all. On the other hand, if a woman has weak adrenals to start with, for whatever reason, and the ovaries shut down at menopause, then the adrenals can't pick up the slack, and then she's going to have hot flashes until her body eventually adjusts to that or it's treated.
Wow, that's interesting, huh?
That's the predominance. Yeah, I find the chemistry of it fascinating. It's pretty simple stuff, too. I mean, most people are intimidated by that, but actually this is kind of like high school, you know, education.
This should be taught in high schools, a lot of this that you're talking about right now, but it's not.
I agree completely. It's just not taught. I don't know if it's by design or by accident, but it's amazing how we can go through all these years of schooling and not learn hardly anything about the body, really.
It's a shame because it's so interesting.
It is. I find basic body chemistry very interesting. So getting back to the thyroid, let's say that a woman's been on thyroid medication for 10 years, 20 years, whatever.
Okay.
And now we're getting into the 2000s, you know, the new decade here, I should say the new century. And now the medical community is shifting. So let's say she's been taking the amount of medical thyroid, prescription thyroid that she needs. And her T4 is good and her T3 is good, but her TSH is low. Because if you're taking what you need as far as thyroid hormones go, you don't need any TSH. There's no risk to low TSH or high TSH. The drug companies tried to sponsor this research way back that indicated that women on Synthroid, which is the most common thyroid medication, were more prone to having osteoporosis. But that was disproven. And Alan Gaby, who's a medical doctor in the field, has all the research on that. But they wanted to downregulate thyroid diagnosis, I think for economic reasons, because thyroid is so cheap. I mean, it costs you like $15 a month for a prescription of Synthroid. I mean, it's just really inexpensive. And there are over 20 known medical diagnosed conditions that you can use Synthroid for. You know, you can treat depression, you can lower cholesterol, you can fatigue. There's many dry skin. There are many different conditions which are can be treated with thyroid. But for $15 a month, I mean, that's really an economic disaster for the drug companies.
Oh, my.
And so they have systematically altered the way thyroid is diagnosed and treated. So here's a woman who's been on Synthroid for how many years? Now she, the doctor says, well, your TSH is low. Well, if you're taking the thyroid you need, you don't need any TSH. But now he's going to lower your thyroid dose to raise your TSH. That's what's going on. And these people are crashing, and they're struggling, and they don't do well with these adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
That's now how thyroid is being diagnosed, incomplete diagnosis, because they're not looking at the actual thyroid hormones. And then they're trying to regulate dosages with TSH. And I'm sorry if I'm getting too technical here or carrying on.
No, it's very interesting. I want to interrupt and say something that I experienced with clients or with people I knew many years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
Which people who have thyroid issues or are suspicious, they need to see a naturopathic doctor or a clinical nutritionist or somebody who works in the more traditional way of diagnosing and treating thyroid. The new way, the HMO way, the managed care way, is a disaster. It's not doing justice to thyroid diagnosis or treatment.
Well, Jim, tell people briefly what the thyroid does, because sometimes we forget, like there's a lot of things it does. So can you give us a thumbnail there?
Sure. Well, the thyroid is an enormous player in the energy, the entire metabolism of the human cell.
Mm-hmm.
So the entire cell, the cell's ability to produce energy, which is called ATP, is absolutely dependent on thyroid hormone. Your body, your cells, and that means the function of the cell, whatever the cell is programmed to do, make this, make that, or whatever. As well as just the general state of health of the cell depends upon thyroid function, so thyroid hormones. So when your cells can't function, everything breaks down. Your brain, the ability of the brain to do what, for brain cells, nervous system cells, like I said, every cell in the human body has a receptor receptor site for thyroid hormone.
So you can get sluggish, you can get stupid, you can get mentally unbalanced, you can get fat, you can get thin, right?
Absolutely, and you can get high cholesterol. High cholesterol is associated with thyroid. Dry skin. I mean, all the cells in the body. Of course, cholesterol is regulated by the liver, made by the liver, regulated by the liver. No matter how much you eat, and so liver cells depend upon the thyroid. The cells have no energy without thyroid. They can't do what they're supposed to do without thyroid. And so the thyroid affects everything. I mean, there's nowhere you can draw the line and say, oh, this isn't affected by the thyroid. Everything is produced and by the cells of the body.
Hmm.
The entire biochemistry is all dependent upon cellular function. And if the cells don't have thyroid hormone, they can't do their job.
So it's really pivotal. I mean, I'm listening to you going, boy, it's really, really pivotal about who I am, being in the neck and all that, eh? It's like a really pivotal thing, and so many people have thyroid problems right now.
And are going undiagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
because they're using TSH and they're not really trying to look at the thyroid hormones. most people who are being tested for thyroid function don't get a free T3. Some people do, and that's the most important thyroid hormone. Some people do get a free T4, but they're basing all their decisions on TSH. And it's a huge mistake, and it's allowing millions of people, mostly women, to fall through the cracks, and they're not getting diagnosed. And if they are getting diagnosed, they're being treated inadequately. They're not taking enough of the thyroid they need to get their free T3 up.
So you're talking about hair analysis. Will that reveal all that?
You know, what's unique about hair analysis and thyroid function is that the hair shows you indicators about the actual, doesn't obviously tell you if a person is hypo or hyperthyroid, but it tells you the nutritional characteristics that go into thyroid support, particularly the mineral characteristics of thyroid support. And in hair analysis, that boils down to the calcium-potassium ratio,
okay. The
ratio in the hair between calcium and potassium. Potassium in the thyroid and potassium in iodine, because iodine is obviously the key mineral for the thyroid, they're closely related. You know, potassium iodide is a common salt like sodium. Like sodium and iodine and potassium and iodine. In other words, there's a real affinity between potassium and iodine. And when you look at a hair chemistry, if the potassium is low and the calcium is high, that's the biggest giveaway that the thyroid is at a disadvantage as far as producing thyroid hormone because of this mineral imbalance. So the calcium-potassium ratio in hair analysis is indicative of the nutritional support of thyroid function. So in other words, if you have a good calcium-potassium ratio, your body's going to handle thyroid hormone activity much more efficiently. It's not just the availability of the hormones, it's also how the body handles them.
Whether it can metabolize it. So we have to end this, and I hate to let you go because this is so exciting for me and I'm sure for the listeners. Do you think, I have one final quick question, and I'm going to ask you to please come back on in a few weeks, if you will, or a month or so. But what about this high-speed pressure we're under with communications and travel and, everything's so fast and vibrationally it's really fast. Doesn't that mess up the thyroid too and metabolism, or does it not? Or do
you
know?
I don't know that that specifically messes up thyroid function, but it certainly creates a lot of stress, and we've got enough stress in our world the way it is. The pace of our lifestyle, the digital reality of everything that's going on, you know, the cell phones, and that's not even to mention the microwave and the electromagnetic field exposure from all this electronic world that we've created. And this is all new relative to, you know, human experience. I mean, I don't think any of this ever occurred before. It's new in our experience, and it's an unknown quantity. We don't know what's going to happen with all this electromagnetic field exposure and the pace and flying here and flying there. I mean, everything is so fast. And the electronics of our world just speeds it up even more.
Everything's immediate, too, eh? I mean, I want it right now.
Well, and I find it myself. You know, I'm at my computer, and I'm searching for something, and I click on it, and I'm sitting there going, come on. In 10 seconds, you know, and 20 years ago, it would have taken me, you know, 15 minutes to look it up or find the information. And
I'm sent it out to the library or snail mail. That's a little farther back. Okay, this is Jim Emke, everybody. And Jim, give people contact information. And I sure want you to come back on soon, if you will.
Sure, I'd be delighted to. Well, my last name is spelled E-H-M-K-E, so it's a little bit unusual spelling, E-H-M-K-E. And my phone number here in Bellingham, Washington, the center of the universe, is 360-734-9777, 360-734-9777. And we now have a website that we've put up. It's called goodtothelastdrop.com, goodtothelastdrop.com. It's actually a site that's dedicated to water, and yet we're going to use it because it's a catchy name and it's a name people can remember easily. It's going to become a site where we'll do a lot of nutritional work as well. Mm. And then my regular email is emke5 at AOL.com, the number 5, emke5 at AOL.com.
Well, Jim, once again, I'm very, very excited and inspired because you really help people empower themselves and their health. So this is Veronica Entwistle saying, I hope that you're going to give us some feedback on some of the information that Jim Emke gave us today in this very exciting interview. And he's going to come back on. So you might want to send me, veronicaentwistle.com, the Ask Veronica button, kinds of questions you want to have answered by Jim coming up soon. So thank you very much for listening. Many blessings, everyone. We'll talk soon.